When we think about the problems we might face as we get older, we often think, firstly, about the physical medical issues that are often associated with aging and that tend to make life more difficult for most people. But there's also a whole life's worth of experience that might affect how our older years play out. That's where today's guest, Michael Toews, comes in with his speciality. Michael is a lecturer in public health and social determinants of health at the University of Lincoln, and he takes a very different approach to understanding aging. Michael's work focuses on trying to understand the social aspects of aging amongst older LGBT people, to understand what the problems are that they face, and how as a society we might be able to go about trying to fix them and make them better. I'm Matt Young, and welcome to Spotlights.
Hello there, Michael. Thank you for joining me today, and welcome to Spotlights.
Hello, Matt.
It's great to have you with us today. So, Michael, why don't you tell us who you are, what you do, and what your research is all about?
So my name's Michael Toews. I'm a lecturer at the Lincoln Medical School. My full title is Lecturer in Public Health and Social Determinants of Health. And alongside, obviously, lecturing and teaching students, all of those kinds of things, I also do quite a lot of research around LGBT communities. So that's lesbian, gay, bisexual, and trans communities. And I guess you could say the way I came into this, I was initially working in local government. I did that for quite a few years. But alongside that, I was quite heavily involved in voluntary sector organisations. So I manned things like a switchboard that offered advice to people who were newly sort of questioning their sexuality or gender identity. And alongside that, I realised we were speaking to quite a few older people on the helpline. It had originally been set up thinking perhaps it would mostly be younger people who needed help. But we were finding actually getting quite a few older people who had questions. And then alongside that, the opportunity came up to sort of return back to academia, do some studying, do some research. And so from that, the project I took ahead was looking at the experiences of older lesbian, gay, bisexual and trans people in healthcare.
So through your experience, as you said, you used to work on a switchboard, on an advice board. Why is it the focus of the research in particular to focus on older LGBTQ people?
Sure. Well, I think there's lots of interesting things that come up around this particular population group. So, I lecture in public health. And one of the things in public health is we're really interested in how people's experiences, things that kind of go beyond just the medical stuff, affects their health outcomes. So, for example, I mean, the obvious examples might be behavioural things. So things like smoking or alcohol consumption obviously affect our health, but also things like where we live, the community we live in, our friendships, our social networks. And if you think about today's kind of current generation of older LGBT people, people who might be in their 60s, 70s, 80s today, there's been an awful lot of social change. You know, if we go back, it's not, you know, there are people alive right now who will remember when it was illegal to be gay, when you could be arrested for it. Or if we think about, some people might have been watching the recent television program called It's a Sin, which was looking at the experiences of people during the HIV crisis. Again, that generation of people will probably be coming into their 50s, 60s, 70s right now. If we think about legislative change, we've only fairly recently had laws that protect people against discrimination in work or in services. So if we think about the people who are 60, 70, 80 right now, they might have experienced various forms of discrimination or things like the HIV crisis earlier in their life. And if we're thinking about aging, lots of things that make difference to us as we get older are things like our pensions, whether or not we own our own homes, whether we live with a partner, all of those kinds of things. And actually, for older LGBT people, all those kind of historic problems will probably be feeding into how they might experience later life. So that's kind of where I'm coming from in terms of an interest. I guess the other point, if I want to be really personal about it, is obviously I'm gay myself and I'm also trans myself. And so one of the things, the conversations I have sometimes with my peers is, well, what will happen to us as we get older? Will we have the services in place that we want? Do we feel comfortable that, for example, if I ever need a care home or if I ever need a carer coming into my house, that I'll get a good quality care? And so those are the kinds of questions that we're interested in exploring, talking to people about, and that's why the focus on older people in particular.
Yeah, that's a really important point to make, I think, in this, in the context of your work, is really how when we come to think about our health, particularly getting older, the first thing that will come to people's minds is more the medical side of things. You know, do people have access to the right medication? Do they have access to any mobility aids that they might need? That kind of thing. But I think it's a really interesting and overall unexplored world when we come to think about other cultural and societal factors that are affecting our health. I don't think, at least me personally, that's not something that always comes to mind. And I think it's great to see that someone from this community is also heavily involved in this kind of work. What experience or what do you think it adds to your work as you being a gay trans researcher involved in this area?
I think it's really helpful in a lot of ways. I think sometimes, and again, this is one of the things I used to find a little bit when I worked in local government, was you'd see policies come out and perhaps they were well-meaning, but they haven't phrased things in quite the right way. They haven't asked quite the right questions. So sometimes I think when you're sort of situated in a community, it's just a little bit easier to pick up on things like nuances of phrase. I mean, for example, we do know that terminology changes quite fast for this community. And so, for example, you might just phrase something that perhaps just feels a little bit out of date, not quite how people would prefer to be asked. And also just, I think, awareness of some of those concerns, awareness of what might be worrying people. Sometimes you just pick up on things a little bit quicker. And I think it's all part of just general kind of, it's good to get diverse perspectives on these issues. I mean, for a lot of the work I do, for the project I'm specifically going to be talking on about a little bit later, I work with other colleagues who have different backgrounds and different experiences to myself.
So when it comes to working with these older communities, I think something that I'm curious about is how do you go about finding them, especially since you're working with them right now during the COVID pandemic? We know that that makes it really tricky to get in touch with and work with anybody. But if you're working with communities that might have particular difficulties, you know, connecting with people maybe normally, I bet that's quite a bit of a challenge. So I'm really interested to know how you go about working with them and finding them.
Definitely. I think it's one of the really big challenges with working in this field is that actually we don't have very good data out there on older LGBT communities. So, for example, this year is the very first year that the census has even asked people about their sexual orientation or their gender identity. And so that can make it really hard when we're going out and trying to reach these communities to be sure, well, are we reaching a representative group? Are we reaching the right groups of people? So for the project I've been working on specifically recently, which was actually very much looking at the experiences during the COVID pandemic, we went through a lot of voluntary sector organisations. So we specifically did some outreach with voluntary sector organisations who were really helpful in helping us get it to the right people. Again, one of the advantages perhaps of having researchers who are a little bit located in these fields is we sometimes have our own networks. I was working with some quite experienced researchers from other universities. So my colleagues, Sue Westwood up at York and Trish Hafford-Letchfield at Strathclyde, and they had some really good networks as well. So we did some outreach, those kinds of routes as well. But yes, I think it's always a challenge trying to get to a variety of different people.
Yeah, I can imagine. And you know, well done to you and your team for making those connections and really getting out there to support them. So when we're talking about what you do with these people in your field of research, what does that actually look like? What is it that you're doing when you're trying to understand their world, the problems that matter to them, their perspective?
The types of research I've been involved in have mostly been either what we call qualitative research, which is research that generally involves talking to people, interviewing people, sometimes getting them to give us written submissions. And that kind of research is really good for kind of getting in-depth sense of how people are feeling. So in interviews, you might ask people, well, how have you been getting on recently? Ask them about their healthcare experiences, ask them about the challenges they face. And you get some really quite personal in-depth stories through that. The other thing we've been doing a little bit of is some survey-based research. So that's the kind of thing that you might quite frequently have seen if you ever filled out an internet survey, which asks a range of different questions. So we captured some demographic questions. So some questions asking things like people's age, their ethnic background, obviously their sexuality and gender identity. But then also, because we were doing some research specifically looking at experiences of the COVID pandemic, we asked things like, how has your mental health been recently? Questions around, well, for example, who people were living with, who they were getting support from, those kinds of questions.
So when you're preparing your questions and deciding what routes to investigate, there's going to be a lot of issues and particular concerns that are already very relevant and specific to these populations, such as older LGBT people. And I was wondering if you could expand on those and tell us a bit more about what issues were informing this research. So when you were going into preparing your questions and deciding how you were going to survey these folks, were you looking for things in particular? Were there problems that you already knew as the researcher that they were problem areas that you wanted to focus on? If you can just give us a better idea of what those might be.
Sure. So I think there's a range of things that we already had some idea might be a problem. So one thing we know is that older LGBT people tend to be less likely to be living with partners than the general population. Again, that may be linked to some of those things I was mentioning earlier around perhaps historic experiences. Obviously, we've only fairly recently or relatively recently had same-sex marriage in the UK. And so when we're thinking about things like how people might react to a situation like COVID, obviously we've had lots of restrictions on how we can go out and about, how we can socialize. We thought, well, that might have an impact on, for example, whether or not people are feeling isolated. We can also think about things that might be barriers for people in terms of accessing services. So quite a lot of the advice that was coming out around sort of COVID was sort of assuming that people would feel comfortable perhaps drawing on support from their local neighborhood, support from their local community. And we were thinking, well, if someone's had bad experiences in the past, are they necessarily going to feel comfortable? Are they going to be worried about discrimination in those kind of situations? There's also been some conversations in the past about older LGBT people's social networks more broadly. So quite a lot of older people, if we think about the general population, have been married and have children. And so the expectation might be that if you're in a crisis situation, perhaps you'd be expecting your children to help you out a bit. But what we think quite often might happen with older LGBT people is they haven't necessarily been married and had children. Obviously, again, we've only fairly recently had legislation that allows LGBT people to adopt. Someone who's in their 60s and 70s might not have ever been in that position. Or if people have biological families, they might have lost contact with them in some way. So perhaps, again, when attitudes were more restrictive in the past, they might have ended up being cut off from some of their family. So what we think might happen with LGBT people is they might be more reliant on their friends. They might expect their friends to be the people who they would call on in a crisis. But then if you've got a situation like COVID and the kind of impact that has on people, where perhaps people might need someone to pop out and get the shopping for them, those kinds of things, perhaps LGBT people, do their friends live locally? If their friends are also of a similar age, perhaps they're also shielding. They've also been told, don't leave your house. And so those kinds of situations, perhaps that does make a little bit of a difference in terms of where people can access support. We also think there might be differences within LGBT communities. We tend to use this acronym that puts everyone together. But in fact, people can have quite different experiences. And we know that, for example, trans people during the sort of COVID crisis, there's been a particular impact on some of the health services trans people use. So things like the specialist gender clinics, they already have really long waiting lists. But during the COVID pandemic, a lot of them weren't necessarily as able to offer appointments at all. So that might mean that someone perhaps had some kind of medical treatment scheduled that they couldn't go in for anymore. And again, that can have an impact on people.
You've mentioned quite a few times that one of the reasons you work with older LGBT people is because there might be this effect where they experience different problems and different issues because of how the changes in the law and attitudes and societal behaviors and attitudes have changed over the course of time, and they haven't been present and consistent throughout their life. I was wondering if you could expand on that and just to help people who might not be LGBT understand a bit better just really what impact that has on those people.
Sure. One concept we use quite a bit sometimes in health studies is called life course theory. And that's kind of idea that all through your life, you have experiences that impact on your health. So if you're thinking even really sort of basic stuff, like, for example, when you're a small baby, if you've got the right nutrition, that might impact on things like whether you get heart disease 40, 50, 60 years down the line. So the idea of this kind of idea of life course theory is people's experiences throughout their life have an impact. And that can apply, I was talking there about nutrition, but it can also apply to some of those more social experiences. So for example, there can be an impact of things like, if you've experienced discrimination in the past, that can cause something that we call minority stress, where people have perhaps had upsetting experiences in the past that have an impact on their health, and an impact quite often on mental health particularly. So that can perhaps mean people are at more risk of problems like depression. So the impact of life course theory can also have an impact when it comes to relationships. So if we're thinking about the stages of, in people's life in which they do things like have a career or get married or all those other kinds of big life events, the fact that perhaps 20 or 30 years ago, people weren't able to get married, they felt that they might be discriminated against at work if they were very open about their sexuality, that may have prevented them doing those things at that time. And even if they can do them now, being able to do them now may not entirely correct problems that were in the past. For example, our pensions are generally based on what we've earned over our careers. If someone had to leave a job because they were being discriminated against 40 years ago, that might still mean their pension's been impacted all those years later because they weren't able to progress in the way they would have liked. I think also there's perhaps a more personal thing that if you've spent a long time not really feeling able to talk to someone about something, then it can be quite hard to change that later. So for example, during the PhD research I did, when I first came back to academia, I was talking to a lot of older people about their experiences of healthcare. And some people spoke to me about something that's called conversion therapy. So that's sort of where someone has therapy that's aimed at changing their sexuality. And in the past, that could sometimes involve quite damaging procedures. So things like giving people electric shocks to try and get them to change who they were attracted to by showing them certain photos and then giving them electric shocks. And I was speaking to people who were in their 70s, but who'd had that experience when they were in their 20s or in their teens. And they'd had that experience because of services they were referred to on the NHS. And so there may still be an implication when people go into health services, they may still, somewhere in the back of their mind, have, well, when I went to see a doctor about this 40 years ago, the doctor wasn't very supportive, sent me to a service that said it wasn't okay to be gay. Does that still continue to have an impact on how people engage with health services today? Perhaps it might a bit.
Those are some really impactful life events that can absolutely change the course of someone's life. And I think it's really easy for us as human beings to be very focused on the present and the now and have a bit of a short-term understanding of the impacts of our lives and what we do, just by nature of us being human beings. You know, I'm a neuroscientist by background, so I know that human beings are not great at thinking about things in a broader context all the time. And so it can be very easy for us to forget or not take into account how things that happened many, many years ago can still seriously impact us and influence us today. So it makes complete sense to me why this would be such an important thing to take into consideration for these people.
Sure. And I mean, I think I don't think it's just an LGBT thing. I'm sure if you've got older relatives, if you speak to older people, many people will tell you about experiences throughout their lives that have had a really key defining impact on them. And so that's what I mean when I say I'm interested in life course theory. I'm interested in how people's experiences throughout the whole of their life will have an impact on them and continue to have an impact on them.
So the million-pound question here is, what are you finding out from this study? I know you're still in the process of completing it, and there may be things you can't answer or things you don't yet understand, but I'd be really interested to know where it's taking you so far.
Sure. I think one of the things that's really interested us in terms of coming up with our findings. So what we did was we did what was actually what we call a mixed methods study. So it involved both a survey of older LGBT people and also a load of interviews that we did alongside that, both with LGBT people and also some support, some charities and similar organisations that provide support. So from these sort of findings, it is sometimes a little bit interesting when you're trying to put together findings from a survey and findings from interviews. But what we're finding actually is quite a lot of diversity. So what we're finding is some of our respondents said to us, actually, you know what, we've really enjoyed lockdown. It's been a great experience. Can take time off work, can spend more time with my partner. Actually, we've been able to slow down and have a much nicer pace of life. So actually, for some people, it's been really positive. Some people have said that their social networks have switched really well to going online. A lot of people have had, we've had some really interesting conversations about the impact of online technologies and things like, for example, when we were talking to some of the voluntary sector groups, that some of the volunteers were telling us, well, for LGBT organizations, often things are kind of organized nationally. So if we want to do some kind of consultation, people were having to get on the train from wherever they might live and go down to London to participate in a consultation. And they're saying, actually, it's been a revelation how much we can do online. You know, perhaps we can join social groups that we would have thought were too far away in the past. So actually, there's been some really positive things. I think what it's highlighted, though, is the kind of, I guess, almost the impact of some of those background features we were talking about in the past. A lot of the people who've had really positive experiences have also actually specifically said to us, we feel like we're really fortunate. We feel like we're really fortunate because we live in a supportive community. I've got a great network of friends. I've got a nice house. I've got a lovely husband, whatever it might be. But then there's been other people, perhaps whose social networks weren't quite as strong to start with, who perhaps were already feeling quite isolated. And actually what's happened is with COVID, some of those social networks that they had have been closed down a little bit. They've had less access to support. They haven't necessarily always felt confident accessing sources of support. We think there might be some interconnections with other aspects of people's experiences. So it might not just be about being LGBT. It might also be about being LGBT and for example, having a disability or being from some other minority background. So we think it's been quite a range of experiences. I think on the really positive side, it's highlighted how diverse a lot of older LGBT people's social networks are. So it's kind of highlighting a lot of the research has kind of suggested quite negative things about older LGBT people's networks, that it's all bad, that everyone kind of has these worst social networks, doesn't have support from their friends and family. And actually, lots of people in our survey came back to us and said, you know what, I've got great support from my family. I've got all these local neighbours. I've got all the support around me. But as I say, I think there's also quite a few people who've come back to us and said, well, actually, there isn't really anyone I count on for support. There isn't really anyone I feel I can call on. I think when we spoke to some of the voluntary sector organisations, they were quite worried because they'd done a lot of services face-to-face. They'd run things like befriending services or kind of community-based services. They'd run a social meetup once a month. And some of those things don't translate so well online or by telephone. They have made real efforts. They've gone out of their way. They were sort of setting up, as I say, all these Zoom meetings or telephone befriending services. But they were a little bit worried that perhaps there were some people for who those weren't as good solutions, weren't as accessible. I think the other thing that we kind of picked up on is when we think about LGBT voluntary sector organisations, there's a real range. So there's some big national organisations, but there's also some really small little groups that might just be a coffee group in a local town or a swimming group where, for example, a group of trans people who don't feel confident go into the main swimming sessions locally, meet up and have a trans swimming session once a month. And some of these groups are really small. They're perhaps running on volunteers. They perhaps don't have much of a budget. And what we were finding, even when we first started collecting data, so about 3 to 4 months into lockdown, was that some of these groups were starting to get a bit worried about, well, how would they continue during this sort of period of lockdown? And so we think there might be something around perhaps some of that infrastructure gets lost during this lockdown period. So there might be some need for extra support for those kind of groups and organizations to get back up and running when hopefully all of this is over and we can do things like have coffee meetings and swimming sessions again.
That's really positive and really encouraging to hear. And I'm quite surprised and impressed actually, because I personally have really struggled to get on board with the Zoom socials and socializing online. But at the same time, I'm so pleased to hear that older folks who most of us thought maybe they would have challenges and difficulties with it have really been able to embrace these changes and they've worked for them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably stretching a little bit too much to link this very directly to my research. But I think one thing we do sometimes see is that perhaps older LGBT communities, because they're quite geographically dispersed anyway, perhaps people are a little bit more tech savvy. Perhaps people do have more experience of using the internet or social networks. I think also just in general, the older population is much more tech savvy than perhaps it was even 5 or 10 years ago. People really do make much more use of it. I think we do have to be a little bit cautious with some of our research. It does go back to the sort of problems we sort of mentioned earlier when we talk about how do we reach people, how can we be sure we're they're representative. And one of the big problems with the LGBT research and this kind of survey research is there might be some groups that we aren't reaching. Perhaps the people who aren't so tech savvy aren't finding out about our research. So that's part of the reason why we did the interviews as well, to try and make sure we got a bit more of those in-depth perspectives about where some of the barriers might be. But yes, in general, I think there is a lot positive to take away.
Looking ahead to the future of your research, seeing it progress and maybe onto looking into the next projects and follow-on research, what do you hope to accomplish from it? What do you hope that your field comes out with or finds, and how do you hope it's used in the wider world?
Sure. I mean, I think there's a lot to be done in terms of applying some of these findings in the wider world. So actually, I had a meeting, well, I gave a presentation quite recently to a local organisation that works with older people in a kind of care and end of life setting. So I was talking to them about some of these findings and how perhaps those might impact on their services, for example, helping make end of life services more inclusive to older LGBT people. I mean, it's interesting because obviously in a way, I kind of hope we end up making ourselves redundant, that we end up perhaps in 30 or 40 years time, we don't need to be talking about ways in which older LGBT people might be having a worse time of it, because hopefully by that stage, they won't be anymore. But I think there is a little bit of work that's still needed to get us there. I think quite often with issues around LGBT issues, sometimes people are perhaps just a little bit uncomfortable talking about it, perhaps don't quite understand why diverse life experiences might make a difference. And so actually it's quite good just having some of these conversations, talking about why it might matter, talking about the range of different experiences people might have and the ways in which what we're doing in healthcare, in social care, we should be thinking about, well, how might our service, we should be thinking about different service users' needs and how we can adapt health services to try and give people a service that meets their needs.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I really hope that we can work towards that kind of future as well to make the services really work for the people that they're serving. So best of luck to you there. We really can't wait to see what your research comes out with. So Michael, thank you so much for joining me today and for talking all about your fascinating world of research. Before I let you go, is there anywhere that our listeners could go to find out a bit more about your work and particularly the project working with older LGBT folks?
Also, particularly for the recent project around COVID and the experiences during that, we've set up a project website, and what we're going to do is when we publish all our reports, we'll make those available through that. Those won't be the academic publications that are very wordy and designed for academic journals. What we're going to do is some easy read summaries that sort of summarize our findings for perhaps a wider audience. So those will all be available on the project website.
That's fantastic. That's exactly the kind of reports I like to read. So yeah, thank you for that. We'll make sure that for all our listeners that the website is linked to in the episode description. And that just leaves me to say thank you again for joining us today. And it's been a real pleasure to chat to you, Michael.
Thanks very much, Matt.
Spotlights is produced by me, Matt Young, for the University of Lincoln in association with Siren Radio. To learn more, visit spotlights.blogs.lincoln.ac.uk. Thanks for listening.